For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, the Troglodyte Twins, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell and Mr. Mark Tuttle, the cavemen. And gentlemen, we have a guest with us today. We won't insult him.
Right. Yeah. Best not. He's a judge.
Right.
He can make our lives change. Let's put it that way. We have, once again, it's a great pleasure to have the Honorable Scott Cirk back in the Catholic Cave, talking here in the wake of the Kavanaugh hearings, brought up all kinds of stuff. You're going to really want to dial up this show with the Honorable Scott Cirk with us here. Welcome to the Catholic Cave once again.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I mean, with so much going on, it's hard to know where to start. So I want to, let's begin though with you, if you don't mind. For our audience, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I'm currently the Hancock County Circuit Court Judge. I was appointed by Governor Eric Holcomb in December of last year. And prior to that, I was the Chief Deputy Prosecuting Attorney, as well as a public defender and general practitioner lawyer since 1988. I'm married and have three children, and I converted to Catholicism when I got married, and have found it to be truth. So it's been a great gift in my life.
We're going to bring up that word truth again, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and you're a very faithful Catholic, too, because I met you because we would go to 6:30 a.m. daily mass, and you got to be a kooky Catholic to be that kind of committed. So, but that's how we got to meet each other. What a great friendship we've had.
Thank you.
So let's start. You know, it's been Kavanaugh, right? So, but one of the things
we're not going to exempt ourselves. We're going to talk about Kavanaugh right here in the Catholic Church.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Well, I don't think not so much in a replay of the past events, but boy, it brought up a lot of interesting things I'd love to get your perspective on. Maybe a place to begin would be that's been on my mind is one of the criticisms of his nomination was this concept of judicial temperament. And they brought in senators brought up and others brought up, you know, Kavanaugh's judicial temperament. Could you tell me what do we mean? What's meant by judicial temperament? And then maybe let's talk about that just a little bit and kind of what are they getting at when they're saying someone doesn't have the right temperament to be on the bench?
Well, judicial temperament is extremely important as a judge. You treat each individual who comes before you with the greatest respect, and knowing that each individual is coming to you deserves to be treated fairly. And so I believe in the courtroom, every judge should strive to be that way, to be patient and to treat people with the utmost courtesy and respect. In fact, when I have pro se litigants before me, when I explain the process, I say you treat the other party, it's usually a divorcing husband and wife, mm-hmm. but I say you treat the other party with the utmost courtesy and respect. And that's what a judge must do in his courtroom to convey that. And from all that I've heard about Judge, now Justice Kavanaugh, is that always in his courtroom, he exhibited great judicial temperament. And I think in the first phase of his confirmation hearing, he exhibited that. In the second phase, it's a different setting, and he was angry, he was hot, and some of the questions from the Democratic senators, he did not convey that. I think he's even said that since then. However, that's a different form than how judges.
Right, he's not adjudicating a case
right.
at that point.
Yeah, he was grilled
with all sorts of wild accusations.
Yeah, he was really sitting in the place of the accused at that point. And that brought up another question about temperament. You know, as a judge, if you're in that situation and you're adjudicating a case and the accused is losing his temper a bit, and how as a judge do you react to that, and what does that, I guess, how does that kind of color the case in front of you?
Right. Well, my first thought on that is that usually the attorneys will make a motion or state something in regard to that, and then with the attorneys, we always say this is an argumentative question, and we will sustain an objection to that and not allow that. But we would admonish a witness or someone if they were getting that extreme. However, with him, if there had been an objection, I would say, you know, judge, you need to answer the question directly. Try not to engage in comment on the attorney or the person who's questioning is all you would say in that. But he was in a very different situation too, and I think that comes out. I was thinking of my own self when judges are out of the courtroom, sometimes like in a campaign, even sometimes I got, when I felt like I was being criticized, I felt I came in a little too hot as opposed to
difficult not to,
right?
I mean, you feel so, like someone's attacking you,
right?
Naturally defenses want to come up.
Naturally defense. Yep. And he was in a different situation. So I think all in all, it's a very difficult situation you're put in, and I'm not sure that's the fairest way to judge judicial temperament. You judge judicial temperament by how the judge acts on the bench with the litigants.
In the courtroom.
And ensures every litigant, whether you disagree with them or not, you do the right thing. As a judge, you're primarily not the actor. You are the umpire. You call balls and strikes.
Gotcha.
You're digging a little deeper into this idea of judging temperament. You know, there's a time and a place for anger. There's a time and a place for emotion. And I think, you know, society at a whole wants to kind of say, no, there's never any excuse for losing your cool. But, you know, you go back to the Bible, you look at Jesus. There were times
money changers in the temple.
Yeah, you could say he lost his temper. I mean, you know, he and not only the money changers, but you know, some of the harsh words he had for other people
for
around
the Pharisees,
him, for the Pharisees, etc. You could almost
whitewashed tombs. I mean, he was pretty
exactly.
critical.
Yeah, not only pretty critical, but once again, you could almost say he kind of lost his temper. So, when is it okay, I guess, to a certain extent, to lose your cool? And how do we judge whether somebody is in the right when they're hot under the collar or not?
Yeah, you make excellent points. And I guess in regard to the Kavanaugh situation, it was probably justified that he conveyed some anger or emotion. If he didn't, I think he would have been criticized similar to how Michael Dukakis was when he was asked how he, in a presidential debate, how he would respond if someone had killed his wife, and he responded with to the death penalty with absolutely no emotion. So some emotion would just been natural in regard to the situation because of the nature of the allegations going against him. You have a man who had been in the public arena for over 25 years easily, that had treated women with nothing other than respect. It wasn't anything like, say, the Alabama Republican Senator candidate, Roy Moore, who had been had a record of not treating women with respect. And the Republican leadership, in fact, had said, had he even been elected, they would have immediately had problems with him. So there was a huge difference there. So I think the unjustness caused some of the emotion. And in some ways, I'm not trying to, but I think the judicial temperament argument, they were opposed to him for any reason possible. So I'm not sure that that was sufficient to indicate improper temperament.
Yeah, I'm wondering too, as I was watching that case and following the Kavanaugh nomination process, one of the other issues that came up really was this presumption of innocence. And it seemed as if the way Kavanaugh, with the allegations against him, that he was treated with, kind of guilty first, and then he had to prove his innocence. And the justification for that, or the reasons, some of the reasons I heard that given by some of the senators was that this is a quote-unquote job interview, and therefore they dispense with the presumption of innocence. But that sounds un-American to me.
Well, not only that, but I, you know, if I were in a job interview and somebody made an accusation like that and expected me to defend myself as part of the job interview, I'm not sure I'd stick around for that job very long.
Yeah. It came across to me as, you know, I've heard it put this way, you know, Mark, you know, when did you stop beating your wife?
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's an implied.
There's an implication there. And, you know, the presumption of innocence, you know, was pointed out, you know, this is a bedrock of our Constitution as Americans, constitutions with a small c. But it's also a Christian principle. You know, it's not just. You know, it's not just the benefit of the doubt that we give people because they're American citizens. This is the benefit of the doubt that we ought to be giving people as Christians. And I feel like, you know, this was sort of a bellwether that we've lost that notion, not only, you know, in a hearing for a Supreme Court justice, but we've lost that notion just in everyday life.
Yeah, what I would say with this whole Kavanaugh situation indicated is how far we've deteriorated politically and how our political discourse is. Justice Scalia always said he never attacked people. He only attacked ideas.
Yes.
And we've lost that. A moment in the Kavanaugh hearings when Lindsey Graham expressed his anger at the Democratic
Senators. Oh, did he ever? He really let loose, yeah.
That brought to mind to me something I thought, you know, I've seen that before. And then I had to reflect on what I'd seen. And it was when Joseph Welch was angry at Senator Joseph McCarthy because of the seriousness of the allegation that someone may have been a communist at some point in their life, he was using that for political purposes and gains. Senator McCarthy was censored from the Senate. It defined a thing that we said, defined a definition that we said we abhor in America, in American politics, McCarthyism, which is attacking for political purposes without substantial evidence or without reasonable evidence. And we all despise that. I fear that we're getting at a time where the nature of the allegation, the person's politics, are more important than the behavior. And we used to condemn that. We condemn that from President Eisenhower, who was also a Republican, of course, to a majority of the senators. There's very few Democrats, even reasonable, respected, great Democrats, that have said, or at least I've not heard it, that have said, the way Judge Kavanaugh was treated was not proper in American politics. And that's sad. That's a sad comment.
Well, we are coming up on a break. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more, I think, about this idea of debating or not debating ideas, but instead attacking people. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a ministry reaching out to Central Indiana and beyond. We have information available about what's happening in parishes here in the Hoosier Heartland, as well as access to the latest from Rome, plus apologetics and authentic Catholic teaching. We are your source for 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. We are talking about the courts, those who run those courts, and how they get to those positions. We've been talking about the Kavanaugh situation.
Not basketball courts.
Right, Tim,
although we could.
How did we ever come up with this as a topic for a show, you know, now? I mean, you know, what
completely out of the blue.
Exactly.
It seems that's all we've been talking about.
Right. But, you know, we were talking about how politics has degenerated to the point where there's no longer a discussion of ideas. It's now a contest of personal attacks. And there's a flip side to that. And I was watching the Indiana Senate debate the other night and noticed how, you know, honestly, how little substance there was within the debate. To the point where we're so used to this back and forth attack and, you know, attempts to smirch somebody else's character, that we really have lost the ability to talk about political issues, to discuss our differences in an honest sort of way. I mean, politics is built on the idea that you're going to have two adversarial points of view, and there's going to be an exchange of ideas, and from that, the truth is going to emerge. That's what our judicial system's based upon. It's an adversarial system.
Or the best ideas should win.
And so how harmful is it when we're no longer able as a society, I think, to exchange ideas in a comfortable way without it turning into personal attacks?
Extremely harmful. As you were speaking, I thought of this point, there's particularly in regard to the Senate debate, there's three parts to every political argument: logic, ethics, and emotion. Logos, ethos, pathos. And we have totally lost logic and ethics. Our arguments politically now have become 90% emotion. If you can tell a story with emotion, you carry the day. And we need to get to a point, just as what you were saying, there the citizens are crying for Mike Braun, Senator Joe Donnelly, and the Libertarian candidate to speak issues. But instead, what works in politics today, and it's gotten worse in our lifetime, is emotion carries the day. If you can tell a story with emotion, you've won the political argument, or they believe they'll win the political argument.
And that's not a situation that's come out of the blue. That's been a long process.
It's
a long train.
Yeah.
Of removing.
We're nowhere near the caboose either.
Right, but of removing logic and ethics, logos and ethos. You know, that's the postmodern movement. I mean, when you look at kind of the history of philosophical ideas, you can go back to Derrida and, you know, kind of see that, you know, his claim that
Foucault, too.
Well, Foucault to a lesser extent, but I'm thinking more Derrida.
Derrida for the truth, I would
right,
say.
Right, that there's only pathos, right. Yeah, the logic and ethos, those are illusory. There is no such thing.
Well, they might be part of the patriarchal hegemony that's causing all oppression
and the way that you can
setting.
Right and the way
so
that
the postmodern
you,
has to get rid of it
right the way that you can tell that is just simply how you feel about a given text or feel about a given piece of speech. You know, the logic and the ethos, that's not available to us. All we have are our emotions to go on. That's got a long philosophical patrimony.
Or
there we go. That's
heritage.
What I'm looking for. Patrimony, right. Yeah.
I used to say you could tell who was going to win the presidential election by who was best on TV. And I think that started with Kennedy.
Yeah,
Kennedy was
Nixon.
Better
right.
than Nixon. And you could always tell it. And in 2016, I said, who's ever best in reality TV will win. And I think we have made that switch to where, and reality TV, whatever it is not reality. It is emotion. It is prying on emotion, who has the most emotional story. My oldest daughter used to like to watch those shows, and my youngest son said, why do you like to watch those shows? They're either crying about a broken nail or going to jail.
Right.
And there's some truth. If you ever, I haven't watched them since my great daughter has moved and been very successful in business and marriage, but she enjoys those shows, but they're pure emotion. My youngest son nailed it.
You know, I remember in school having to study the Lincoln-Douglas debates as the epitome of public discourse. And I think we've lost sight of that, of, you know, when you talk about that mixture of logos, ethos, pathos, you know, those Lincoln-Douglas debates exhibit all three of them. And I think, you know, even from our beginning education up, we've lost that ability to try to cultivate that mix of looking at things through those three lenses at the same time.
That brings to a whole other point, but we've always had conflict, we're always divided, but it appears we're as divided politically as we were at that time that you brought up in the 1850s, 1860s. But Lincoln's approach is so tremendous. And, you know, when he won re-election, when he thought he was going to lose, his inaugural address was nothing about him or his political prowess, which most politicians would do. It was, we're all at fault. We're all in this together. God controls the, you know, using God. A story I love about this may be a little too off point, but I love this story. Frederick Douglass told. He said he witnessed Lincoln's second inaugural, and then he went to the White House for the reception, and the guards were going to remove him because of the ethos or the pathos of the time. Not the yeah. emotion of the time was yeah. so, you know, we've had this emotion, something we've overcome as far as race, but we had it then. And Lincoln saw him and said, "No, let my friend Douglass come forward." And so he brought Douglass off, told the guards to leave him, and said, "My friend." Mm-hmm. And then when Douglass approached him, Lincoln said, "Douglass, what'd you think of my speech?" And he goes, "Oh, Mr. President, you don't want my opinion." He goes, "There's no man opinion who I'd value more." And, you know,
that does sound like a right. bygone era.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So he let go of the emotion.
Yeah.
He respected him as because Douglass yeah. was a great intellect as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lincoln recognized that. So, right. But that's what we need. We need to get emotions always going to be part of it. It's always going to be part of politics. Right. And there's some importance to it. But it's one of three. And we got to get more of the ethics, the logic, and then what we said before. You don't attack people. Right.
When you go back and you study ancient rhetoric, I mean, and the way those three go, the purpose of pathos is to reinforce and draw people to the logic of your argument
or the
goodness of your argument. Right. Exactly. So, you know, there's a hierarchy there, and we've gotten the hierarchy completely reversed.
Yes.
You know, we appeal to emotion to try to cover up bad arguments and bad arguments on both the logical and moral side of it.
Yes. And for those listening, just a reminder that we have a special guest in the Catholic Cave, the Honorable Scott Cirque, and we've been talking all things political and judicial. I want to, sticking with this theme though, I'm wondering, in as a judge and as you're making rulings and working through cases, are you finding that more and more of the litigants that are coming before you are very stuck in a sort of an emotional state? And so when you try to introduce the rule of law, so logic, the good, the true, and the beautiful to them, and how you're trying to sort these things out, do you find that there's an impediment there? Or do people, you know, because again, we seem to be in a kind of state culturally where emotions kind of dictate reason. And then and your role, though, is to do the opposite, right? It's to interject reason into what might be a very emotional setting. How do you go up? Do you find that's the case? And if so, how do you go about doing that?
Well, I think that's very true. For a judge, I think sometimes you're doing your best work when you decide the case based on the law, precedent, statute, but it's not necessarily how you'd like it to be decided. And I think you've got...
Because you're following the evidence and the logic.
You have to separate out maybe as much as you can as a human, your personal preference or your emotional side.
Yeah, or biases that you just... Biases, inclinations that we might have.
It's extremely... one of the most important things for me is my faith. But I have to decide that every case, your faith is part of you, but you have to decide each case primarily on the facts. You have to separate that outside the facts and wherever that takes you. And sometimes it may take you to places that you disagree with in other ways, but you have to decide that as a judge. And one thing I would say is, like, just for this example with young children, the parents are divorced or never been married. I have a, you know, mothers are essential, but every person I see to my right that I'm sentencing in a criminal case, the one consistent thing is they did not have a father in their life. So when, every time I have a father who's fighting, I am so, I want to just say, keep it up. You need to be there. However, to get joint legal custody, they have to be able to agree. If they can't, you have to make the best decision you can. When children are younger, under a certain age, there is, you know, that life in some ways is unfair to men. There is going to be a preference, particularly if they have a daughter. But the father needs to stay in the life. So you sometimes make tough decisions where you want to say, Dad, I'm just looking at you thinking, keep it going. But I'm going to have to decide this because based I can't on the law, give joint legal custody when you and the mother can't get along, but you're still involved, you know.
Right.
So that's just a tough thing, but we have to do that. But again, the role of a judge is to apply the law fairly to each individual before. And if you can't, like if I had a case that I could not ethically hear, you know, I need to excuse myself from that case. Or if I felt that this was in constant conflict doing the job, I need, you know,
Find something else to do.
In fact, not to get too much in this, a great Catholic juror or a Catholic jurist who I believe, I don't know his faith so much, but he had a personal tragedy in his life. I'm going way back. But Judge Taney, who was Catholic, right before the Dred Scott decision, his wife and daughter had died. They caught tuberculosis, and he had insisted on them going on a trip. That there was a scare of that, but he said, we'll be fine. Well, they both died. He stayed on the court, and then he decided, he felt he was going to try and end the Civil War within a few years of that, and he decided Dred Scott, which probably exacerbated the Civil War and was a poor decision using substantive due process, which unfortunately has been used in other major Supreme Court cases that are controversial. That's probably the worst. So my point on that is, if as a judge you can't emotionally take that job, you need to resign or conflict, so because it's a tough job.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the conflicts that arise within the law, possibly for a Catholic, and sort of that intersection between law and faith. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. We'll be right back after this break.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a website, catholicradioindy.org, with access to great Catholic resources, including podcasts of all our local programming, podcasts that have been downloaded from all 50 states and over 40 countries on 6 continents. Yes, we are Catholic Radio Indy, but thanks to your support, we're taking the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, and we have a special guest in the cave with us today, Judge Scott Cirk. And we were talking before the break about this balance, I think, to a certain extent, of as a judge, you trying not to allow your own biases to infiltrate how you interpret the law and how you look at the law. We have a system where we have a separation of church and state. You know, there is no established religion within the United States. And when we look at the laws, we're supposed to look at it from a religiously unbiased perspective. How hard is that? How often do elements, I guess, of public morality that seem to conflict with the laws? And I guess one of the biggest examples, you were talking about divorce cases. Obviously, the church teaches divorce is kind of a fiction spiritually. You know, when you're married, you have one marriage, and there is no divorce. You know, I think we just went through that reading. You know, the within the past couple of weeks that you know, if you remarry, you're committing adultery. That's not the law of the land. That's not the way the law. So how do you navigate those types of conflicts between Catholic morality and what's actually there as, you know, the law of the United States?
Right. Well, the first answer I wanted to say is that I have to act always as a judge and cannot let my any favoritism to Catholicism or that affect how I view the litigants. However, like I believe in Catholicism, I believe it is ultimately the truth. It's the church that Christ started, and the doctrine has not changed. And you go, you know, like Cardinal Newman said, you go deep in history, you cease to be Protestant. I think with deep study, that's the truth. Politics and other things, more than religion, help cause that split way back 500 years ago. That being said, though, so I think you have to approach it that way. We do not want, we don't want to follow Iran and have a theological government. That's always a disaster. However, how we were created, how the West Enlightenment was created, is you don't enforce your religious views, but they drive your ethics. They're part of your life. There's something more important than politics and government. And in divorce cases, what I was just going to say, though, what I always tell people is at a divorce, as I always say this, you're a family. You're still you're a broken family now. You're still going to be a family. If you have children, you're going to be relating to each other. And the key to a broken family and broken family is forgiveness. And you always want put the children first. You want the children to go safely from dad's home, mom's home, and back, unaware of the anger, hurt, and resentment that caused the breakup. That, well, I'm not trying to say that's Catholicism, but I am trying to say there is a truth. What you said is true, and that's what the church teaches. That's what Christ said. If you're bounded together in a valid marriage, you're bounded together.
And recognizing that fact, you can bring aspects of that to bear on that particular case and use that as a chance to try to instruct the couple and help the couple along.
Right, without saying this is Catholic teaching, I never do that to my knowledge ever, or ever say anything that this is what Christ said. Now, I have said sometimes, you know, the good book that we swear people in, it says in there's more damage that comes out of the mouth than what we put into it. And we need to watch our words, that type of thing.
Right.
I'll say general things like that. But the other thing that I'm noticing in my entire legal career is the culture knows less about that.
Less and less about the good book.
Right.
The good book, a reference to the good book isn't good. Isn't always
they
well
still
understood.
They're not sure what you mean,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they don't know what I mean. And then the other thing is like the prodigal son.
Right.
The prodigal son, to me, is a story that when I was a kid, I'm 56 years old. When I was a kid, that was in the air. You heard that. Not only in Sunday school, you heard that. Today, it's not known.
Right, yeah. I'm teaching faith formation at a Catholic parish. I'm shocked at the religious ignorance of people who go to church and families who, you know, they've got a vested enough interest that they're enrolling their kids in faith
formation.
It's
as if they're in a cave.
Yeah.
Wrong cave.
Yeah. But yeah, the ignorance, I think, of what, you know, a generation or two ago was honestly common knowledge. Now is, I mean, even within churches.
It's obscure.
Yeah.
It's obscure knowledge now. And I think, too, I wonder if that's part of, if you'd see it this way, I wonder if you would consider that part of why we're politically and culturally so fractured, because one of the things that we've lost is this common heritage of these important stories. Because once you hear, like, the prodigal son, I'm so glad you brought that up. When you hear the story of the prodigal son, you hear the and understand this notion of kind of impulses of selfishness at first that lead to a kind of self-destruction and a loss of and separation, but then that return and the father's forgiveness. These are important lessons for our lives. And when we're ignorant and have not been exposed or heard or understood these stories, then no wonder we can't relate to each other as well as we ought to be able to, because we've lost the narrative.
When I was a public defender, when I would meet the clients in jail, sometimes I would ask them, do you know the story of the prodigal son? An overwhelming majority of them did not know the story. Mm. And I would stop and say, how do you think the father reacted when the son came back? And 75% or more would go, oh, he was mad.
Yeah.
See, they don't
give
know.
Give him a whooping.
Right? They don't know the unconditional right. love of God. Mm. And that is being lost in our culture, too, that unconditional love of God. And that story is so great because when you tell it in the context that Jesus told it, like just for the fact that a father would run, lift up his robe and run to see his son, that would never happen. That would be like a shock. Mm. But that's what he did. So he's conveying this great love after the son had said to him, Father, you're dead to me. I mean, that's what he was really telling him. Not just that I'm moving away. You're dead to me. I'm taking mm-hmm. my share and doing what I want. And then for him to respond that way. So I think, too, we lose the story, but then it's been lost in the culture.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the loss of those common stories and sort of a, and not only the common stories, but a common story, a common sense of history that brings us all together. Once again, it goes back to that postmodern movement of, you know, the insistence that, well, there is no, you know, set narrative that all of us hold in common. We all have our own individual stories. None of those are right or wrong. They're merely attempts at asserting our own power over one another. To get back to that, I think to start to unwind some of these problems we were talking about, the discord, the hostile political environment, etc.
The loss of truth.
A lot of it is to go back and regain these common stories, these common narratives, and start to try to build up a common culture again.
Well, I do like one phrase that that has emerged from Protestant circles that I am in favor of, that to as a part of the antidote to what you're talking about, this post-modernity that we're in, is a biblical worldview. Now, I don't think it's a sufficient. I think you need a Catholic worldview.
Right.
But I do think that they're touching on something when we are familiar with the sacred scriptures, where we're encountering God, not just only at Mass, but on a daily basis, reading the sacred scriptures, learning and gaining wisdom from it, learning what our story, so we have our stories that we can share and hold in common, that we can learn and be transformed by. That I think is part of what part of the march out of postmodernity has got to include a deep connection with sacred scripture together.
Right, because it doesn't only draw us closer to God, it draws us closer to one another, and it builds
people of God.
It builds community, not only through mm-hmm. common beliefs, but once again through common stories, through a common narrative, through a common heritage, through a common
stories.
Culture. Right?
We love stories. I mean, we love books. We love movies. You know, movies are nothing but mega narratives, right? That we're telling ourselves. I was going to ask though too, or kind of bring us back around something we talked about, Judge, last time you were in the Catholic Cave, was this crisis of fatherhood. Tell us a little bit about what are your observations about the state of fatherhood kind of in the culture, especially from perspective of being a judge?
Yeah. It's lost. There, first of all, too, fathers aren't being encouraged. We're getting, instead of men and women realizing that we're complementary, we're getting the thing of men and women at war. There's a female way to do it and a male way to do it. And instead of seeing it complementary, we're saying they're in conflict. And we've got to be moving to that. So that's a loss. But just the involvement of fathers too in lives, we're seeing less and less people getting married, and that again is a way
that's detrimental to the children.
It's detrimental to the children, and they've lost that active role. There are fathers that are trying to assert themselves, but again, the culture, we're almost moving to the single mom, and it shouldn't be negative to that, and women are tremendous and great, and we men know we love, and you know, like when Adam first saw Eve, he was thrilled beyond belief.
Right.
When you read the ancient Greek, but we're complementary; it's not one. So we're getting to the point where we're almost beatifying the single mom as the best way. Well, it's not. It's best the combination. Something I always
and all the social science backs that up. Yeah. I mean, when you see when you see children being raised by their biological mother and father that are in a permanent exclusive relationship we call marriage, all of the outcomes are better.
Well, going way back to the 90s, Dan Quayle was mocked for making fun of Murphy Brown, but Atlantic Magazine came out who said Dan Quayle was right.
Oh, yeah,
he was. And we were already starting that other movement with emotion and other things over the facts. So that's always a concern. But I always want to, fathers are important, and it's a great gift.
Well, we're going to need to take a quick break. We've been speaking with Judge Scott Cirque, and we're going to talk more about this crisis of fatherhood when we come back.
You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy thanks you for your support.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell.
You think?
As far as I know.
Therefore I am.
Unless Derrida gets to me. But our special guest, along with, of course, our co-host, Mark Tuttle, producer Kent Blanford, we have Judge Scott Cirque. Welcome. We've been having a fantastic conversation about all things... I guess law-related, political, but now we've been pivoting a little bit towards fatherhood, and I want to continue with that conversation a little bit in the crisis of fatherhood. One thing that I want to give you a lot of credit for, last time you were on the show, one thing you pointed out to me, and I've quoted you numerous times because I thought it's so spot on, is that when you'd have young men who had gotten in trouble and came before your bench, you know, you'd look at them and you'd say, you know, if you had a father like I had, you wouldn't be here today. And I thought that's such a great, poignant summary of how important a role it is for us for fathers and for men to, that we're all, I think all men are called to fatherhood. That doesn't necessarily mean we're all called to be husbands and generate offspring, but there's obviously spiritual fatherhood that can be exemplified in, say, holy orders, right, through the priesthood. But just being a mentor to a father figure to children and to others, I think is so important. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about, in your faith life, you're a husband and a father in your faith life, tell us a little bit about the importance of fatherhood and what a difference that make. I know we were talking about women and men too. I've also heard it said, you know, men and women are equal but not identical.
That's well said. I think that's so true. That's something we need to remember. But yeah, I mean, I was just blessed with a tremendous father. I can't say that enough. A tremendous mother too. The nicest kindest person is my mother. She's I'm blessed with both of them still being alive, of course. I'm old, but they were.
I'm the same age you are, so.
but I was gonna say I sometimes say this with young couples who have children. Oftentimes they're not married today, but I say my parents were 19 when I was born, and they immediately sacrificed their goals and dreams for myself. And then, and that's what parents do. That's what we're supposed to do, that lack of selfishness. But my dad has, in particular, as a father, has always been that way. And he continues to teach me. Right now, my mom has very severe health problems, and he is taking care of her. And he was a football coach, and somebody had contacted me. They were at the high school he coached at. They were going to do a history of it. And he asked me, how was my dad? And I mentioned that. What he's doing, he goes, I'd expect no less from him. And that's the kind of man he is and always has been. And he was also, as a coach, he was one of those guys who, and I could never do it, but he could get men, boys, young men, to do what he wanted without yelling and screaming. Just that type of man. But he was blessed with a great father, my grandfather, who I often say to people, the hero in my life was a tenant farmer. You know, I happen to be a judge. When I walk into a room as a judge, everybody stands up. When my grandfather walked in a room as a tenant farmer, no one noticed. But he's a better man than I am. And he truly was like that. But he had the blessing. But the story I was going to tell is his father, he didn't know his grandfather. His father, his grandfather, way back in the early 20th century, left his family.
Oh, wow.
And my great-grandfather was raised by people who didn't love him. But for whatever reason, he became a good man. I was never blessed to meet him. He raised my grandfather, but my grandfather tells the story. He was on a bus in the second grade, and then he saw an old Model T smoking up and a guy there, an old guy there, and the bus driver said, Bob, do you know who that man is? He goes, no, I've never seen him. He goes, that's your grandfather.
Oh, wow.
And he was in second grade. By the time I was in second grade, my grandfather was at every event I was at. You know, and that's how he was. But when he went and told his dad as a second grader, you know what his dad said? I wonder when he's going to be in jail next. That's what he said about his father.
Oh,
so you can break this cycle, and I hope we do. I don't have the story of my great-grandfather, how he broke that, but he did. And then since then, you know, the most important, I sometimes tell people this, the most important title you'll have is father. And that goes for me. I hope my three children feel that for me. And that's what I felt from my dad, and he felt from his dad. And there's a certain type, but that bad cycle can be broken. Other men can raise up and be your father figure.
You know, that bad cycle, so much of that is described in our culture as toxic masculinity. And, you know, I think part of the problem is to realize authentic masculinity, to realize what it authentically means to be a man, you have to be in a relationship with a woman. You know, to draw out what masculinity properly is, you only see that in relief of a good wife in the context of a family. And so, you know, there's a certain self-perpetuating nature to it.
You're getting very politically incorrect.
Well, that is true.
That is true. Yeah. It's true. I mean,
women inspire us to be better. If we didn't have women in our lives, we would not inspire to be better than what we are.
Yeah. There's a, you know, I'll use the D word, domestication, but it seems that young men really benefit, you know, young men in their 20s, benefit from family life, from taking by I think it's the shouldering of these additional responsibilities, this idea of loving someone other than yourself, just as you were saying, Mark, brings out the best in us. You know, what would you say, Judge, are, based on some of your experiences, what would you say are some of the root causes of this crisis of fatherhood? How is it that we've gotten, you know, as men, we're we're really shirking our duties. What are some of the things that you think are going on that are causing that?
Some of it is men need leaders. They need to follow by example, and we're mm-hmm. losing that in the culture. Some male traits are being attacked in the culture as well, and they
television instead,
and they should be lifted up. Yeah, the defining. I like the show, and I think it's a great show, but the defining father figure of our lifetime is Homer Simpson, and he's the dumbest man in the room.
Right.
And that's
great example.
That's not, you know, it's a great show, but that does not help. And in fact, instead of encouraging, men are the best and the greatest when they sacrifice for either their family or a great cause. That's something we're meant for and that we can do. And women, whatever you want to say, they have a complementary role, but it's different. They're not to sacrifice. In fact, I've heard the statistics. I talked earlier about the Civil War. If women were in combat equal to men in the Civil War, it would have destroyed American population. You know, it would have had an effect on the population.
Right, yeah.
Sure.
There's a difference to that, and we're meant for different things, and we got to encourage the masculinity and the culture, and encourage men that they're not to act for, you know, we have too much of men acting for their own pleasure at their own time, playing video games instead of doing something productive as a quick answer. And then the other thing is saying they're sorry. Well, if they say they're sorry, instead what we want men to do is think of the consequences of the actions before they engage in them, not come later and say, we're sorry for what we did. That needs to be, it's an important part of it, but it needs to be lessened, and we need to think of the other first, and that only comes from example and leadership.
Yeah, that's a great way to summarize that up, example and leadership. I mean, and again, I think we all have, whether we're all called, all men are called to this state of fatherhood. It could be the single guy who's coaching the team. That's going to be your example, your opportunity, your opportunity to set the right example and to lead young men. And there's lots of organizations that are other ways to get involved, too.
Yeah, and I think you bring up the key to that is self-sacrifice. That, you know, the way that you express yourself as a man is by putting yourself in situations where you are giving yourself fully, completely, totally, self-sacrificially to others. You know, whether it's protecting and providing for your family, or whether it's sacrificing your time, your talents, your abilities for the sake of a little league baseball team. True masculinity is that sense of self-sacrifice.
Yes. So we're going to run out of time here again already. We only got a few minutes left. So we've been speaking with Judge Scott Cirk. Thank you so much for coming into the Catholic Cave. So we've covered a lot of different ground here today. Maybe as we wind up the show, share with us a little bit about kind of looking forward, looking in towards the future. In terms of, we've had the Kavanaugh nomination. Now that's we're in the wake of that. Let's say that's at least in the rearview mirror. It seems. What do you see going forward in terms of, say, nomination processes, the rule of law, the culture, any of those sorts of things?
Well, I'm always an optimist. Always an optimist.
All right.
I believe the United States of America deserves an optimistic view from what it's done in the past. That's the best way to learn from history. I think we're going to learn from these things, and I think we are going to get better. And the other thing is, you can trust the American people. Those without partisan political views right now, I think, have evaluated the Kavanaugh hearings probably correctly, and we'll go forward, and hopefully we'll be better, and we'll be more focused on maybe the Scalia example. You attack or argue ideas. You don't attack people.
That's great.
Yeah, and trying to keep those differences in opinion, differences in ideas in perspective, and giving, I think, your political opponent the benefit of the doubt. You know, these are genuinely good-hearted people that we differ politically with, but it's not because they have a distorted moral character. Well, I guess maybe on some issues it is, but exactly. But I think for the most part, people come at these from a perspective of goodwill, and we have to start giving people the benefit of the doubt.
And that is about all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for this week. For Timothy O'Donnell, for Mr. Mark Tuttle, and for Judge Scott Cirk. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.